You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. And this is Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Candivero. And we have our next guest coming up.
Rick Rozoff. Rick, are you there?
Yes, I am. And thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for joining us, Rick. This is Ken. Our guest, Rick Rozoff, is a Chicago-based geopolitical analyst. Many of Rick's articles on global military strategy are published in the think tank Global Research. Rick is also the founder and manager of the international email news list Stop NATO, which critically examines NATO's worldwide expansion. And thank you so much for being with us tonight, Rick. Our listeners are, of course, very aware of the U.S.-led wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But what I learned from reading your articles is that these wars are just two components of an expanding U.S. global military presence. Could you talk about the U.S. global military strategy?
That's a very important question, and we could go on for hours, but I'll try to be as concise as I can on this. Unfortunately, we have to, I think, situate everything within the context of the last 20 years, which is not only the end of the Cold War, but the end of any military power that could seriously present a challenge or even an obstacle to global U.S. Military designs. I'm talking about the formal dissolution of the Warsaw Pact and the fragmentation of the Soviet Union in the same year, in 1991, which was also, of course, the year of Operation Desert Storm, which in many ways was the opening salvo, I think, in the United States announcing itself as the uncontested global military superpower. I don't know how many of your listeners read our current president's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech last December, for example. One will appreciate the irony given the venue and the occasion, but he quite avowedly, unabashedly rather, identified his country, our country, as the world's sole military superpower. That's a quote. And, there was no...
Don't be shy.
Yeah, exactly. No hesitancy, no shyness about that. He was quite, thumping his chest, and then at the same time, bemoaning the fact that other countries resent that fact, right?
They're villains
for resenting our uncontested global military dominance.
Don't they know we're here for their protection?
Well, now, NATO is a North Atlantic treaty organization, right? Wow. What does it have to do with places like Afghanistan?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I just wrote a recent article, and I talk about the integration of Pakistan into NATO's global military network, in addition to Afghanistan, which is a little better than a military colony of NATO right now. By the way, that's NATO's first Asian war. It's NATO's first ground war, something it never fought during almost half a century of the Cold War. Initially, under UN auspices, there was something set up called International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, which very quickly came under NATO control. And currently, there are officially 46 nations contributing troops to NATO command for the war in Afghanistan and adjoining countries. I mean, we have to realize, the war is spread across the Durand Line into Pakistan. In addition to those 46 countries, there are a good half dozen more who have troops there but are not formally troop-contributing nations, as NATO puts it. So, for the first time in human history, a military bloc has troops from over 50 nations serving not only in one war theater, but in one nation.
What was the legal hook that the United States got NATO involved in Afghanistan?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you asked that. Article 5 of the NATO founding document is basically a military mutual support or self-defense or mutual defense, I guess would be the polite euphemism for it. But it obligates every member of NATO and presumably a good number of their partners to enter the list or to take up cudgels in defense of any other member that is under military assault. And I think it was understood that, during the Cold War years, as being if a NATO member was militarily attacked. When September the 11th occurred in 2001, NATO, for the first time and to date, invoked its Article 5 for two purposes. First of all, for all other NATO members to assist the U.S. war in South Asia and Afghanistan, but also to set up something called Operation Active Endeavor, which started immediately after 9/11, is continuing and presumably will continue for into the indefinite future. It is a comprehensive maritime naval surveillance and interdiction operation throughout the Mediterranean. NATO brags, for example, to use their own term, hailing 100,000 ships. In that interim between 2001 and now, NATO, for the first time, also has a long-term, again, permanent, presumably, naval operation in the Horn of Africa area, in the Gulf of Aden, and into the Indian Ocean. It's called Operation Ocean Shield. And earlier this year, they announced they were extending it to December of 2012. That is for another 3 years. So the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, has now expanded from 12 members, most of whom did have shorelines on the Atlantic Ocean, to 28, most of whom don't. They have military partnerships with, comfortably, another 30, 40 nations all over the world.
The United States seems to parallel NATO in that it's divided the world up into these global military commands. Could you talk about them?
Yeah, that's another important point I'm glad you've raised. The United States is alone, currently and in history, in having the number of what they call unified combatant commands, but in essence, six of them are major regional commands that take in the entire globe. Some of them were created after World War II, like European Command, Pacific Command. One was formed in 1983 by the Reagan administration, Central Command, which, of course, we know with David Petraeus taking over Stanley McChrystal in the Afghan War Theater. That Central Command includes Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, in other words, the major active war zones currently. And that had been the most recent, 1983, until after 2001 again, where the U.S. created a North Atlantic or North American Military Command, NORTHCOM. But more particularly, I think your readers or your listeners rather are aware that formally on October 1st, 2007, but launched in earnest a year later in 2008, was Africa Command, AFRICOM.
AFRICOM.
Which is, takes an entire continent, 53 nations, and the second most populous continent in the world. It's been arbitrarily assigned to a U.S. military command.
And you mentioned that we have partnerships with 35 African nations. I don't think the American people have any idea that we have these involvements.
American people can't name 35 African nations.
That's terrible, but I'm afraid it's probably true. As a matter of fact, that quote is from General William Ward, who's the commander of AFRICOM, and it's outdated, I think, conservatively, of the 53 nations. It depends on how you count these, by the way. Western Sahara is recognized by most African nations and is a member of the African Union, but is not recognized by the United States and its NATO allies because Morocco seized it in 1975, and Morocco is a military client state of the United States and is a partner of NATO, incidentally, in the Mediterranean dialogue.
And we also have an important command in Djibouti, right?
Yeah, that's the only permanent large-scale U.S. military base in the African continent to date. It certainly won't be the last. There are estimates from 2,500 to 3,000 U.S. troops. They've been stationed there since 2002. The U.S. is it's an old French Legion air base. It's called Camp Le Manier.
And this is in the Horn of Africa? This is kind of
up it's very strategic. It's exactly where the Red Sea meets the Gulf of Aden going into the Indian Ocean. It's an immediate striking distance from and has been used to strike targets both inside Somalia and Yemen.
So you mentioned Somalia and Yemen. I don't think most people are very aware of what's going on there. But there's fighting going on there. What involvement does NATO or the United States have?
The United States, I think, fairly directly. I mean, we acknowledge having launched drone missile strikes inside Yemen. We've done the same, and we have ground operations, covert operations, commando operations inside Somalia. Pardon me, but there have been a number of stories just within the last week that the U.S. is going to step up its support for what's called AMISOM. It's an African Union, in theory, an African Union military deployment to Somalia. It, in fact, consists overwhelmingly of troops from Uganda, Burundi, and Rwanda, which are U.S. military client states. And there was an article in the East African, a major newspaper in Uganda, just last week that hinted that Uganda, which is a U.S. military proxy, is prepared to invade Somalia with 20,000 troops. This is about the same time the U.S. announces it's going to provide more support. NATO is also supporting airlift into Somalia, as it did into Darfur 5 years ago, and expanding its operations on the African continent in addition to off the coast of the Horn of Africa.
Now, why are we in Somalia? What's wrong with this? Is it the Al-Shabaab group mm-hmm. that's resisting NATO and the United States? What is our problem with them?
We're propping up a government called transitional, I guess transitional forever, permanent transitional federal government in Mogadishu, in the capital. And, you know, by universal accord, this regime has very little support, even in the capital, certainly none outside.
It's transitional until it gets overthrown again.
Right, until the next transitional government succeeds it, you know. You know, the standard accusation since 9/11/01, of course, anytime we want to intervene somewhere, we accuse rebel groups or militia groups of having contacts with al-Qaeda, and that seems
to be the magic word.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, starting last December, another U.S. military ally and proxy, Saudi Arabia, got involved directly in fighting in northern Yemen against a minority community called Houthis or Houthis, a variation of Shia Muslim. And, you know, there's no indication, being Shia, that they would have any, you know, connection with al-Qaeda, of course, quite the opposite.
Right, they're the enemies, aren't they?
But Saudi Arabia launched just blistering jet fighter attacks and artillery attacks, killed, you know, maybe several hundred civilians. The U.S. was accused by the Houthi community as being involved in that attack. And this, of course, is long before the Christmas Day, or weeks before the Christmas Day airplane bomb scare outside of Detroit, which was then used, you know, as the excuse for intervening further in Yemen.
What is the fear? Is that these Shiites in Yemen, if they take power, will form an alliance with Iran?
I've been told that the particular brand of Shiism is not one that is at all close to the dominant version in Iran, and that probably is not the case, whereas, you know, that's been used for Lebanon or Iraq. I don't think it's really applicable to Yemen. But you also have, you know, mass resistance to the government in the south, which is not only secular, but traditionally left. You know, it's a remnant, so I think they still call themselves Socialist Party of Yemen, which appears to be the major opposition group in the south of the country. And, of course, you know, starting last December, when the Obama administration authorized military strikes inside southern part of Yemen, the accusation, of course, was al-Qaeda.
Just a moment ago, you were talking about the Shia administration of Yemen and how they're not the same types that rule in Iran. For the casual observer, it is just impossible. Well, we aren't really raised with the kind of religious awareness and tolerance in this country of knowing, you know, who around the world believes what, you know, and I think just like the average person just refers to everyone in the Middle East as an Arab.
Mm-hmm.
Is the administration or the leadership in Yemen, are they softliners or are they hardliners compared to like an Iranian administration?
Well, actually, you know, the political leadership in Yemen are Sunni, you know, by their own personal background.
Okay.
The Houthi Shia minority in the north that's come under attack. As a matter of fact, there's been a resumption of fighting just within the last week after, you know, a peace treaty had brought about a relative period of quiet and peace. You know, they're a secular government with, you know, culturally and historically an Islamic country, majority Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in this case, you know, rather than dwelling on some of the confessional or ethnic and other differences in the country, though I, you know, do believe our nation hires people who know precisely how to exploit those differences whenever it's to their advantage.
For example, in Iraq, the people that we just backed to put in charge are hardliners in comparison to the previous administration, which had more religious tolerance, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, one of my best friends is from Afghanistan, you know, he fled his country as his whole family did after our clients took over in 1992. I think people have to realize, you know, what the war on terror, so-called global war on terror, renamed overseas contingency operations, is really about. You know, Stanley McChrystal, before he stepped down as head, commander of all U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan, you know, last August, September, released what was called the COMISAF, Commander International Security Assistance Force, you know, report that was used as the justification for the latest U.S. buildup there. And he identified three groups that the U.S. was fighting. Okay. And one of them is a Taliban group based in Balochistan in Pakistan. And the other two are the groups of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Jalaluddin Haqqani, who were both U.S. clients. You know, throughout the 1980s, they were the major recipients of U.S. arms.
Mm-hmm.
And funds, you know, against the secular government of Afghanistan at that time. And, you know, now they've become our adversaries. And, you know, as a matter of fact, Charlie Wilson, who passed away earlier this year, referred to Haqqani as goodness personified during that, you know, the Mujahideen War in the 1980s.
Right.
So, you know, it's disingenuous to say the least.
Right. The point you just made about former friends and now, you know, an enemy, that's what we're going through with both potential wars with Korea and Iran. We gave nuclear weapons to Korea. Now they threaten to use them against us. And Iran, we overthrew the democratically elected government to put back in what we're dealing with now. And if we had played ball, you know, 10 years ago with the softline regime, we could have been friends with them. But instead now, by our actions and our you know, trying to honcho around the region and just, you know, rattle the cage, it seems like we've created a much bigger problem.
Well, who was the global alliance we put together? Was it directed against?
You know, that's a good question. Whether we need a certain amount of outsiders we can use as a justification for regional military buildups, that, you know, that's my contention. I believe that's really true.
And what about Russia, China, and Iran?
Well, Russia and China, I mean, almost every report that comes out from any branch of the U.S. service, you know, about potential rivals, you know, Russia and China are right up there, usually ahead of Al-Qaeda. North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, say, are, you know, the regional countries that, you know, we use to arm their neighbors and build up military networks surrounding them. You know, I wonder if every government of the world tomorrow capitulated and came over and told the U.S. it could have everything it wanted, if we wouldn't be in a panic.
What do we want? Is it about oil and gas? Is it about controlling major sea routes? What's the objective of this exercise?
I think you've mentioned some of the major ones one has to assume, or, you know, the global objectives. As a matter of fact, last autumn, ahead of, there's going to be a NATO summit in Lisbon, Portugal, in November, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which again is now 28 members, you know, maybe 40 partners, over 40 partners, is going to formally endorse what they call their strategic concept. The last one adopted was in 1999. There have been a number of meetings held around the world to kind of tout, you know, the new strategic concept. And one of them was held in London last autumn, and it was hosted by Lord Levine of Lloyd's of London. Honest to God, it was co-hosted by Lloyd's of London, the insurance company, which was very concerned about, you know, shipping lanes and shipping routes and
sure.
So forth, because they don't want to pay out on claims, I suspect. So it's becoming, you know, as a matter of fact, Hans von Sponeck, who was the UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq.
My name rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, and, you know, wrote an intriguing article in February of last year in a Swiss newspaper, and the title of the article is The United Nations and NATO, in a section called 21st Century NATO Incompatible with the United Nations Charter. How's that for former UN Assistant Secretary General? You know, actually mentioned that one of the purposes of the expansion of NATO globally was, in his quote, you know, protection of the vital resources, end quote, needs of its members. And
it does sound like colonialism to me.
Yeah, it sounds like global, you know, domination of not only resources, but their transportation, their availability, and so forth, you know.
When we're talking about regional alliances for specific purposes, Asia is certainly a center of interest, too. I understand that there are exercises going on, even military exercises going on even as we speak. China perceives as a threat. Could you talk about those?
Yeah, and, you know, with the alleged, in alleged response to, you know, the sinking in March of a South Korean corvette in Cheonan, and the 46 sailors are killed. I mean, it was a tragic event, but the United States hastily called together some of its allies, Britain, Australia, and for cover, I suspect, Sweden, and, you know, with South Korea investigated it and blamed North Korea for sinking the ship with a torpedo. Chinese and Russian, you know, investigators did not come to the same conclusion, were not invited to join the, you know, the commission that conducted the investigation.
What did they find?
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity. I mean, that's why, for example, earlier this month in the United Nations Security Council, a resolution was adopted on the sinking of the ship, the South Korean ship, which condemned the sinking but didn't name the perpetrator, right? I mean, because two...
Fishy business.
Well, two permanent members of the Security Council with veto rights, of course, are Russia and China, and they did not see it the way the U.S. has presented it. But what the U.S. has done is, you know, used that as a pretext for was what were announced to be large-scale naval maneuvers in the Yellow Sea, which borders the two Koreas to the east, but China to the north and to the west. And they were going to move in the USS George Washington, which is a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, 20 other ships and so forth. It looks like the U.S. is relented about conducting that in the Yellow Sea. Instead, is moving it to the other side of the Korean Peninsula in the Sea of Japan, right off the coast of Russia. So, this is brinkmanship. It's almost gunboat diplomacy. I can only see it as being a gratuitous provocation.
Did Russia and the other countries who came to a different conclusion about the sinking, was there any talk about, unofficially off the record, just saying this could be another Gulf of Tonkin incident where...
Mm-hmm.
I know that's a key word sometimes, if false flag event, but...
No, that's a wonderful analogy, and I fear it already has been used, to some extent for that purpose. And,
mm-hmm.
Whether you taunt another country to send out a ship and then accuse it of doing something, who knows what the true nature of the sinking of the South Korean ship was.
As long as there's no witnesses, you could say anything you want.
I'm afraid.
What do you think the likelihood is that there'll be a new war over Korea?
Ooh. Well, people with some degree of, and some history in observing international events, Fidel Castro comes to mind, a few weeks ago stated there'd be a very real possibility of a regional war, and possibly a nuclear war.
It doesn't help the matter that North Korea is run by, for lack of a better term, screwballs.
Well, let us say decidedly untransparent. Let's use State Departmentese, a non-transparent government. So we don't really know what's going on there either. And presumably also not terribly penetrable by our intelligence agents. But that's a good question. Who knows?
And they're not shy about coming right out and saying, I have a report here from the Australian Broadcast Corporation and from Pyongyang. It says, prepared to launch what it calls a quote-unquote retaliatory sacred war.
Yeah.
And they say Kim Jong-il's regime says it will not hesitate to unleash its nuclear deterrent. Will not hesitate. Wow.
And it's impressing me on how well we've roped in so many Asian nations into our alliance. You say we have missile shield agreements with Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and Australia. We've got troops from Singapore and Malaysia serving in Afghanistan.
Yeah, Mongolia.
And Mongolia. What would they care about?
There are only three countries that simultaneously border Russia and China. There are Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and North Korea. We may set the Korean Peninsula on flame very shortly. This is very serious for Russia or China. In Russia's case, they could have hundreds of thousands of Korean refugees fleeing into the country, and in China, millions. So, these are not things to be dismissed. But in Mongolia, the U.S. every year holds multinational military exercises, Khan, as in Genghis Khan, Quest. There's going to be one in August, which may be unprecedentedly large. And just recently, the president of Kazakhstan was in Washington, met with our President Obama, and immediately afterwards the U.S. announced that they were going to use the country to transport supposedly non-lethal military aid, but also troops, overflight rights over Kazakhstan for the war in Afghanistan. So all three countries that border China and Russia are increasingly being pulled into a U.S. military network, and these can be used for other purposes, for military surveillance.
What are these other countries getting out of the deal? What advantages is it to, say, a European nation like Germany to be involved in Afghanistan?
Boy, that's a good question. A lot of it is simply NATO requirements. As much as they talk about being I think the formal title is a military alliance.
Being part
Democratic
of a club.
States, right?
Of, volunteer time.
I'm sorry?
It's like volunteer time. We'll join a club.
Right. Yeah. Who wants to volunteer first? And on the other hand, Germany is the second largest exporting country in the world now, I believe, next to China. It's become a major military exporter of military equipment around the world. Germany has the third largest contingent of troops in Afghanistan, next to the United States and Britain. It has troops stationed in combat zones fighting, killing and dying for the first time since the fall of the Third Reich. It's had troops in the Balkans. It has troops in Djibouti, by the way, Ken, since 2002 as part of a NATO operation. Warship stationed with NATO groups and so forth. I can't say that, some of the major powers in Europe don't relish the chance of reestablishing themselves also, their military presence.
Especially the French, I would think, about such a big colonial presence in Africa.
Yeah, they, you know, the French community still takes in, you know, as many as 20 countries in Africa, and the British Commonwealth is many. So, you know, here's an opportunity for them to reestablish themselves after the, you know, tremendous anti-colonial drive following World War II, you know, ousted colonial powers who had, you know, exploited nations around the world for centuries. And, you know, I think it's worth noting that British troops are now, you know, back in Iraq, or were back in Iraq, or back in Afghanistan after losing three wars in that nation, being chased out all three times, and are back in countries like Sierra Leone and West Africa, a former colony. And what's true for Britain is equally true to various degrees for France, Spain, Portugal, and the other European colonial powers.
Oh, my goodness. Is it just because certain people, I guess you could say the globalists, just can't give up the idea dominance and just knowing that they rule somebody else? They just can't let it go? I mean,
yeah, I believe so. As a matter of fact, there was a revealing statement in an article jointly written by George Robertson, former NATO Secretary General from Scotland, mm-hmm. and Paddy Ashdown, kind of the viceroy of Bosnia on behalf of the, you know, Europe for a while. And then this is perhaps a year ago, and they said, you know, for the first time in the last 500 years, the West is confronted with a world that it doesn't control.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that statement, more than anything else, you know, doesn't control or is at risk of losing control of. And, you know, what's the new strategy for doing it? Well, global NATO comes to mind.
Well, there's that, there's strategy, but then you also have to have the manpower. And if you can't get your forces motivated to fight these days with professional armies, how do you go about doing it? And so they have to come up with reasons why they have to go there.
Yeah, and there's no, in very few countries in Europe is there popular support for, say, the war in Afghanistan.
So that's why the importance of these local forces, like the Africa Standby Force, we get local people to essentially fulfill our policy, we give them arms and whatnot. I understand that's the new NATO-trained group that we've got going in Africa.
That's a very important point. As a matter of fact, in an article I had written on the Africa Standby Brigades, you know, we have NATO officials saying that they're based exactly on the NATO Rapid Response Forces. First test of the NATO Rapid Response Force was about 5 years ago off the coast of Africa in Cabo Verde. And it was a massive amphibious assault and multi-service military. Yeah, you're right. They're using proxy armies in Somalia and in Congo, you know, wherever else they need to deploy them. And they're being trained and, you know, they're being airlifted by the United States and NATO.
Rick, I'm afraid we're coming to the end of this segment, but if you could briefly describe how you'd like to see American foreign policy changed.
We need to demilitarize. As mm-hmm. you know, the Quadrennial Defense Review that was issued earlier this year, budgets, and, you know, both houses of Congress are accommodating enough budgets, $708 billion for military spending next year, for defense spending, which is the highest in current in inflation-adjusted dollars since 1946, which is, you know, the carryover from World War II. We need to demilitarize.
And that's not even counting supplemental budgets that'll end up being passed when that gets, you know, spent in July.
Well, what, a republic, not an empire.
Right. I mean, everyone calls for that, and in fact, that's the case. Look, you know, you don't hear it spoken of anymore, and it's a real tragedy. But, you know, maybe a year or 2 years ago, you heard leading figures, including heads of state of nations like Russia and China, calling for global multipolarity, for a new global security structure. These are some of the code phrases they used. Unfortunately, you don't hear them any longer, but that's what you need. You need democracy between as well as within nations, is another statement I think that needs to be looked at. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we can't allow somebody to arrogate to themselves the right to be, world sole military superpower.
Right.
And, dictate terms to anyone and antagonize, provoke people the way we've seen. Because you're right, there are other wars going on.
Rick, where can we find your articles?
Just type in Rick Rozoff, I guess, R-I-C-K-R-O-Z-O-F-F. And usually what comes up first is Stop NATO.
Also at globalresearch.ca.
Yeah,
there,
right.
There's a complete list of your articles.
Yeah, to his great credit, Michel Chosadovsky at Global Research in Canada has been good enough to post my articles. I think that's probably how they get most exposure. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Rick,
for joining
we'll speak
us.
Speak to you soon.
Okay, I hope so.
Bye-bye.
I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't.